Hi again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this, I always forget what day it is, Thursday, the 2nd of April. Our guest this hour is the author of Teaching for Social Justice, Voices from the Front Lines. Professor Connie North is assistant professor in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction at the University of Maryland, College Park, where she specializes in teacher and anti-oppressive education. The book is, she said, her take, and it's the people she's gathered, their take as well, on a continuing inquiry into the significance and dilemmas of teaching for social justice. She brought together five, I think, very, very interesting teachers who really are trying to, or four teachers, K through 12 educators, and brought them into the university to explore the meanings of social justice and the applications of its principles in the teachers' classrooms and communities. And it looks at five competencies that are integral parts of the teacher education: functional competency, critical, relational, democratic, and visionary, and how all of those tie into social justice as well. So we're going to have a really good conversation this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Connie North, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I love you're bringing together these teachers because teachers can do incredible things. And I was also struck by how much it is that teachers have to do, in addition to, you know, got to get good grades on the tests, et cetera. But you're dealing, and these teachers are as well, with all kinds of disadvantages in their lives, you know, be it the race they happen to be, their sexual orientation, whether or not they're poor, whether or not they're rich. Teachers have to maneuver all of that with students, and you've put together an extraordinary group of teachers to explore this issue, don't you think?
Well, it was definitely intentional on my part to bring together teachers from very different school settings with different histories, because I thought that that would lead to a diversity of discourse, of conversation, and that worked like clockwork. And then the teachers themselves, I think, are amazing individuals.
Yeah, they are. Is there a lot of time in schools to even devote to this subject, considering the fact that teachers are, it seems to me, given standardized tests to students almost every other month, that they have to cut out whole areas of exploration and teaching because the demands of national tests, state tests, making sure that you teach to the test, you get the best grades so you get more money for your school, et cetera?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, the teacher at the private school in my study, Paul, who's at a K-8 progressive sort of John Deweyan style school, he has the most leeway to practice these sorts of principles and really dive into more student-centered inquiry because he doesn't have to, his students are not obligated to take a test.
Tell me about the teachers you brought together. How did you choose them? Who are they?
Paul he's been teaching for about 20 years at this school. It's K-8 private school. So he teaches the 11 to 14-year-old classrooms. They actually don't have grade level labels. So they're with him for 3 years. It's called looping in educational jargon. And so he has a chance to really develop deep relationships with the students that I think really enhances their learning. And then I also had Joe, who worked at an alternative public high school, alternative in that it has a very strong mission of social justice, anti-racism, anti-heterosexism, that sort of mission. And he taught social studies and art, still does. And he shows up in the book very prominently with his role of having very deep relationships with the students both in and outside of school that I think kept the students coming to school, something that I think we don't talk a lot about in this high-stakes accountability environment right now. Then there was Julia. I'm trying to use their pseudonyms. It's taking me a second not to use their real name. Julia was at a more rural public school that's having, like in the rest of the country, increasingly immigrants from Mexico, Central America, so a growing Latino population in that area. So it's also become more of a commuting town where farms have turned into development areas, and there's a lot of class issues at her school that arise. She was teaching an at-risk program that she renamed to put a more positive spin on it, the Achieve program. And overwhelmingly, even though her student body was almost entirely white, half of her students were not white in that program. So there were a lot of issues of race going on in that school. Margaret is at a charter public middle school teaching 7th grade language arts. And most of her students are Hmong or Latino or African American, predominantly African American. I think one of the highest rates of free and reduced lunch rates at that school. And really struggling with trying to give her students the skills she felt they would need to succeed at high school so they could get their diploma and have more opportunities if they so chose to go on. So that was kind of how I opened up the book with.
She's a real go-getter, isn't she? I'd like to be in her classroom.
Yes, and she's got such a way with words, so she had always good metaphors to throw into the mix.
And had a class very involved, had some interesting, you gotta be creative as a teacher, too, had some interesting ways to get the students very involved in what was going on in the classroom.
Definitely.
Yeah. I'm wondering, the schools that didn't have much of a racial balance here or even talked about issues of heterosexuality, homosexuality, which is not discussed in a lot of schools. Those schools, as I still think we live in a really segregated society, and we do in certainly in this area, one of the most segregated in the country. Can you indeed address the issue of social justice, do you think, if you are completely segregated? If you're not talking about gay issues, if your school is predominantly white or your school is predominantly black, can you even talk about all of this? Or do you have to have sort of what I envision as an ideal school that has the makeup of what America is?
I think you can talk about these issues. I think it's made much more difficult when you don't have that diversity there because, as I've joked before with my students, when I'm the only one offering a competing perspective in the classroom, it quickly becomes that that person is crazy or marginalized or silenced or something mm-hmm. because that perspective is kind of unique rather than just one more perspective in the classroom. I think that's one of the major disadvantages to our segregated society and, again, very much related to how I set up this study with the idea that, you know, we would all learn from each other much more if we actually had some differences among us, that could really enhance our understanding of the world around us.
Right. Let's talk about these competencies that emerged as you started talking about this issue, because I think that these are new to many of us. Functional, critical, relational, democratic, and visionary literacies. Functional, which is something that we think of in a traditional school, right? Yeah, you got to know the material.
Right, and I think it links, I borrowed that from Rico Gutstein, who's in Chicago and works with the social justice group in Chicago. He wrote a book about teaching mathematics for social justice. But he talks a lot about functional literacy in addition to sort of what we think of with traditional education being linked to our larger capitalist system and that it helps to reproduce that so that you have, for example, high-level functional literacy where out of that maybe comes the surgeons or the high-tech folks, engineers, people who have particular kind of lifelong learning dispositions and skills, as well as functional literacy that produces our service sector workers, which is, what, 80% of our economy, I think, at this point. So functional literacy also counts for maybe students who are only tracked into remedial grades and they get the skills basically that they need to go work in a restaurant or something similar.
And some of the teachers may have been more proficient in certain other kinds of literacies, but needed some of the functional. How can you get in trouble as a teacher who's committed to social justice if you don't have functional literacy down?
Right. I think that actually the idea of social justice often gets a bad name in education because people associate it with a lowering of standards mm-hmm. As opposed to the idea that I think all of these teachers were very committed to helping their students succeed in the system as it is, and the dilemma was then trying to push them to also become sort of agents of change to make that system more just.
Mm-hmm. Critical literacy.
So critical literacy would be more the idea that it's okay to be skeptical and to ask questions and to try to understand the larger social, political, cultural context in which we're all looking at different questions or even being educated on different issues. And I think the main thing with that is not just stopping at learning facts or learning information or learning skills, but really kind of being able to take a step back and wondering why we're doing all of these things.
Mm-hmm. Relational.
Relational literacy is what I was alluding to a little bit with Joe, with the idea that it actually, we're talking about human beings here rather than widgets on an assembly line in a factory. And it's very important that students and teachers have a strong relationship, then better even when it's built on trust and respect. And that really enhances the learning process. And I don't think we talk enough about that.
Mm-hmm. And do we train teachers for that?
I think more and more so. I mean, my mentor here at Wisconsin when I was a graduate student, Gloria Ladson-Billings, talks a lot about culturally relevant pedagogy and what does it mean to really be responsive to the different students in our room and really listen to them and recognize that they come to school not as empty sacks, but with all sorts of their own knowledges that may or may not match the teachers, but that should be valued and respected. And I think that, unfortunately, with the testing emphasis, the idea that student-teacher relationships really matter gets kind of pushed off the stage.
And does this include what may be fairly significant cultural differences?
Definitely. I mean, still predominantly, the last statistic I saw was that it's still almost 90% of teachers in this country are white.
90%? You're kidding me.
Yeah, it's up there. It's very high. And so that really doesn't match the demographic of the students in public schools, you know, which in some states already the students of color exceed the number of white students in the school. So
what's the problem here?
I have a colleague, Erica Miners, in Chicago, who's written about, you know, sort of schooling education like social work and other kind of helperistic professions really tending to draw white women. And there's been a lot of history in education about the feminization of education, and that generally that where you see men most often is in administrative roles and leadership roles running the system. So I think in part because we don't necessarily value the teaching profession like we do other professions, you end up getting a lot of people who maybe would otherwise consider teaching if it was valued more going into other fields. And so I think you get a lot of people who want to help, and those oftentimes are white middle-class women.
Interesting. I don't think sometimes it just seems like such a given, Professor North, but I don't think we can underestimate how important it is to have somebody teaching, to have somebody as president of the United States who is somebody different than what, you know, the 90% is. It makes a huge difference in somebody's life if you're a male, to have a male teacher sometimes, if you're African American, to have an African American president or an African American teacher or principal, or not only for the students who are African American, because it does do this all things are possible thing, but also for the people who are in the privileged majority who can see, you know, you reach this colorblind kind of society more if you have that, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can't underestimate the symbolic importance of that. And I had the chance to be at the inauguration in D.C.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Well, it was just this feeling in the air, I felt like, that first of all, it seemed like at least 5 of every 10 people I saw were African-American there. But this sense that finally people felt like they were part of the political process after hundreds of years, and it just was very powerful to be present for that and to just have the sense in the air that there was a real shift in sort of racial imagination, I guess, of our society.
I've remembered something. We have to get him on the air at some point, that one of the assistant police chiefs in this city was being interviewed on public radio after there was a downturn in violent crime in this city. And his comment really struck me. He said, I don't think you can underestimate the importance of an African-American being elected president of the United States, that it's had an impact on crime. That I never even thought of that before.
That's interesting.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? All right, democratic competency. What's that?
So in some ways, I see this as being related to relational literacy, in that how we speak and listen to one another is very important. And I think in our society, we tend to focus on debate rather than more of a dialogue and a conversation and active listening. And so that's where I think democratic literacy sort of begins, at the micro level of people interacting and how we interact with one another. But it extends to an idea that I'm going to borrow from Professor Parker, who's in Washington, that he talks about both enlightenment and political engagement as key parts of citizenship. And so part of democratic literacy is really seeing ourselves as active citizens who have a role in our governance. And instead of, I think we oftentimes see ourselves as clients or consumers at this point in our society, really seeing ourselves as able to influence policies and practices and institutions that affect our daily lives.
Mm-hmm. And visionary.
visionary literacy is sort of my appeal at the end, to pay attention to the fact that we can't really have change if we don't have hope for something different. So having a vision for what could be is, I think, what often drives us to try to realize that better or more just reality. And I think the arts are a key part of that. It's been very exciting to see a lot of youth get involved with the spoken word movement. I think Milwaukee has a vibrant spoken word community. And just how much hope and, again, a sense of agency, or a sense of I can go out in the world and have some self-efficacy and make change, comes from having some vision of something better.
And you're absolutely right that it comes from arts in many ways, doesn't it? It comes from our song and dance and plays and singing and bands and all of that. And getting back to what we were talking about earlier, we don't see as much focus on that. Programs are being cut right and left all over the country.
Right. I mean, it's very sad to see how many art teachers go to school after school after school. I mean, they're set up in multiple schools because there's no longer one art teacher or multiple art teachers within a building. Mm-hmm. It's become less and less important.
So without getting terribly personal, and tell me, but you do write about the fact that you grew up as, you know, pretty well-to-do young woman in Denver, I believe. Are you from Denver? And that you, in many ways, are a privileged person. What is it? Was it your sexuality that got you really involved in these issues, or did you just have a family? I'm wondering what kind of high school you went to. How did you get involved in these issues of social justice? I'm always interested in people's stories in this regard.
I've wondered about that a lot myself, actually. I didn't come out till much later in my life, and definitely grew up in a, you know, tree-lined, very white suburb. My one African-American friend, her father was a Denver Bronco, for example. So I'm not really sure where this disposition came from. In part, it might have come from actually playing competitive soccer when I was young and meeting girls from all over the city who kind of exposed me to other realities in the little bubble that I lived in, and that got me curious. And from there, because of my upbringing and the privileges I've had access to, I had an opportunity to travel, and I first went to the West Indies, to Montserrat, an island that's since been devastated by a volcano. And then went on to do the Peace Corps. And
where were you?
I was in Senegal, Africa. But I think it's an interesting question, and I think the whole idea of sort of our dispositions is something, too, that we don't talk a lot about these days in education. But what is it that helps people open themselves to the world and be interested and curious?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think in part that's linked to visionary literacy and really encouraging students to be creative and have an opportunity to produce something of their own.
So. Right. I think the Peace Corps is a big thing in a person's life, too.
There was no
more
going
people
back.
Should go in the Peace Corps.
Yeah, or I mean, I like the idea that there's more and more sort of service opportunities in the United States, too.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls. We'll do that in a moment. Our guest is the author of Teaching for Social Justice, Voices from the Front Lines. Professor Connie North is our guest, and she brought together four K-12 educators. She's been in their classrooms as well, and she brought them into the debates on social justice. And so they look at different kinds of focal points for social justice teaching, and she's explained them: functional, critical, relational, democratic, and visionary literacies. We have yet to talk more about what it means to teach for social justice. What kind of curriculum do you use? How do we define people who are privileged in this society, who is not privileged in this society? And how, you know, do you get students to really open up about this? We'll talk about all of that and welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that, and that is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now. For Connie, our phone number is 800-486-8655, and let's start with Jackie from Drummond. Hi, Jackie.
Oh, yes, hello. I'm so happy to share this experience with you. I know you've all heard of the book Three Cups of Tea, right, by Greg Mortensen?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, we brought his mother up. She's on a speaking tour. That's my EMT radio. And she came, and she spent a day in the Drummond School. She gave five presentations to the whole class, and the children were so enthused. She focused on education for girls, and how they could get involved with the Pennies for Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And when she finished with each class, she left them a legacy that it was their obligation to work for peace.
Hmm.
And with Greg Mortensen being nominated as a Nobel Peace Prize candidate, how exciting if he wins, because, you know, she has touched our community. So I was just so excited about that, and I just wanted to share that, because when you live in a rural community, you aren't exposed, you know, culturally, and it's mostly a Caucasian community.
Right.
So this was so exciting. You can see I'm still riding high from that, so I just needed to share that with you.
Thank you, Jackie. Professor North.
I think that Three Cups of Tea has definitely gotten a lot more attention than a lot of other things going on in education. So I think it's definitely an exciting and meaningful venture that's gotten a lot of different communities involved.
Which brings up the question of what teaching materials you use to talk about social justice, to broaden people's horizons, to get them understand if they are privileged and who's not privileged and what their life stories are. Is there a set curriculum that you recommend, or how do you include people's own stories in this? How do you bring people out on this issue?
Well, I think there's really some really good service learning models where you get the students. I mean, I think the more ownership the students have over any sort of inquiry process, the better. But to actually get students out in communities talking to people, I think is very powerful. I actually just was at a conference where I heard some young high school students talking about how they were using this different digital technology to go and basically create short videos of people's lives. And they went out and they interviewed folks and they learned their life stories and they ate with these families. And it was a very powerful transformational experience for those young people, I think.
I think it was Margaret, too, wasn't it, Margaret, who had the population of the school had changed pretty significantly, and she had them do research on what the population, am I getting the story right, what the population used to be in the school?
Right. The school had moved neighborhoods, and when the charter school was first started, it was in a much more well-to-do area where there were a lot of children of professors and other sort of white-collar professionals. And the school at that point, the demographics of it were very white. And then it moved to the more African-American part of town. And as she says, in the book, that it was like a bow tie in terms of how the demographics pretty much shifted almost overnight in terms of who went to the school.
Mm-hmm. And so what did it mean for the students to read about that? What did they learn?
I think it gave them a sense of history that I think is often missing, since I think history is often this much more detached, again, sort of facts over there somewhere as opposed to what's happening in our own community and our own lives. I wasn't there for that, but the way that Margaret talked about it was that it was a powerful moment for the students to really sort of understand that things haven't always been the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that their school did look very different just a few years ago.
And do you think there are still problems, significant problems, or do we know better now when it comes to reading books that reflect the world and reflect the history of the world and all of the people who live in this world? Or are we still pretty much, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant guy philosophy in schools, in what we read?
I think, unfortunately, there's still usually a very additive model of we'll just sort of add people into the story as opposed to changing the main storyline. I was actually watching a documentary, Race, the Power of an Illusion, which talks very powerfully about race. But a historian on it, he talks about how the melting pot idea, we don't talk about the fact that actually Latino and Chinese and African-American folks were the wood under the pot, keeping the pot going, that's a very different storyline than talking about a melting pot history.
Well,
and that's not usually the storyline that we're talking about.
Right. Thanks, Jackie, for your call. We go to Laura from Green Bay next. Hi, Laura.
Hello. I would like to say that I pulled over to a parking lot so that I could call, and I think this is an extremely important topic, but I feel, not to be negative about this, but Americans as a whole view education as job training and not really education, and teachers are not valued, and they won't be until we really look upon education as something that nurtures the soul, not just the pocketbook.
Mm-hmm. It's an excellent point.
Yeah, I would have to agree, Laura. Actually, Jean Glass, who's been a longtime leader in the educational field, just wrote a book called Fertilizers, Pills, and Magnetic Strips. And he talks a lot about, well, the credit card industry and sort of what's happened over time in our culture and the sort of hyper-individualism and selfishness and materialism that's kind of guiding our lives for a lot of us, I think, these days, and how we really need to take a step back and think about if this is really the kind of future that we want for ourselves, to be so isolated from one another and so kind of focused on an efficiency model of life, mm-hmm. that we miss the connections that I think you referred to.
Do you think that it's harder, though, Laura, considering the fact that we're in this huge, we just spent the first hour talking about this global economic crisis, which scares the heck out of me after a while, and it scares my, the future of jobs for our family, too, for the children in our family particularly. Do you think it's harder, given what circumstances we face right now, to be able to have that kind of life that you just talked about, or that society is telling us, whew, money is the biggest thing now, you're going to have to be able to keep yourself out of a homeless shelter?
I think you can do both. I think that you can live with dignity and have a good education, and that many of the excesses are what got us into this, not people who are struggling to survive. I just think that, well, for every computer lab that goes into a high school, the art department goes south. And I really think that, well, I taught for a long time. I'm retired now. I taught for 34 years. And kids crave things like stories and art and things that are for them to express themselves. There's a real hunger for it. And those people are the people that become, you know, graphic artists. They don't go out and create their own art because the society is not giving them an outlet. Teachers get laid off, and they already have 30, 40 people in the classroom. You know, I mean, I just know, and I feel so moved by this, that until the society from the top down, and Barack Obama is doing wonderfully because he's such a good example, until the society from the top down says it's important to be educated, not just trained, we're not going to change, you know?
Connie.
Yeah, I think that goes along with definitely this idea of functional literacy particularly, and that, again, that's such a narrow and limited view of what education is and who human beings are. So I very much appreciate the way you distinguish training from education, because I think that's something that we don't pay enough attention to and really talk about the differences between those two styles of teaching and learning.
Yeah. What did you teach, Laura?
I taught in the Howard Suamico District in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And I retired 2 years ago.
Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you for listening to me. I have a lot of passion about it.
Yeah, a lot of people do. Thank you for being with us. And people do. In the teaching profession, people complain so much. Ah, the teachers, they make too much money. I said this to you before we went on the air, there's nothing like a good teacher. There's just nothing more important, I don't think. When you look at what the issues of life, of a substance of life that you're looking at in a meaningful life that you're looking at in your book, and what Laura feels, a lot of teachers feel that way. That's why they go into a profession. It's not to make a lot of money, because it doesn't happen. It's to get at the very stuff that she's talking about and what you're talking about, don't you think?
Yes, I think teaching is one of the most complex, complicated jobs out there. And unfortunately, I think our educational policy system is set up in a way that policymakers kind of often have a view that, well, I went through fourth grade, so I know what fourth grade needs to involve. And that's really unfortunate, because unlike other professions, you know, with lawyers, they have the American Bar Association determining the standards for their profession. The same thing with the American Medical Association for doctors. That's not the case with education. And I think we need to talk seriously about professionalizing teachers, giving them their due respect for the work that they do, and that it's a very complex job that not just anyone can do.
Right. Thanks, Laura, so much for the call. We go next to Michelle from Appleton. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. You know, I'm just wondering if your guest can say anything about the role of the community and about parents in all of this, because I think there's a real commitment on the part of just some communities to keep education, quote, simple, you know, not to engage with these issues. And I'm thinking of a recent issue in Appleton involving the history curriculum of the elementary schools, in which some challenges were made to something that was very violent, and parents said, you know, we need to teach the facts, and why are these, you know, PC liberals coming in and trying to change the way we teach? And I think that that's a real issue, that that parents and community members are suspicious of things like social justice education and critical engagement with, you know, pedagogy, because they think, you know, give the kids the facts without all the mumbo-jumbo and all the PC stuff. And, I mean, in Appleton, it shut down the entire process of trying to discuss these issues with the community groups. And I'm wondering if your guest can say anything to that.
And Michelle, before we do that, can you tell me what the subject matter was? What was the controversy?
The controversy was about a Civil War reenactment where children as young as 10 take guns, realistic-looking guns, aim them at each other on a mock battlefield and kill each other. And some people were unhappy with that, and the district decided to eliminate the battle, and then parent groups signed petitions, and the community, you know, demanded that this activity be replaced. And the reason why it was challenged was because, you know, it raised so many difficult issues, including the fact that in Appleton, children are privileged enough that they don't have to encounter actual gunfire on their way to and from school as they do in other parts of the country. So, I mean, it was very complex, but really, there was a resistance to engaging with these issues, big time. And you know, that is something that I think is a big deal. And I'm just wondering, you know, what your guest, if she has experience with that, or what she thinks about that.
Yeah, there's a lot to this call.
I think, first of all, that there is not nearly enough communication between schools and the surrounding communities in a lot of cases. But as there are other inequalities in the educational system, I think you have the over-involvement of some parents and the under-involvement of others. And often those who are vocal and they know how to work their way through the system and get things done in the school and have the school run according to their wants and wishes, which isn't necessarily the wants and wishes of the larger community. And I think this relates back to the idea of democratic literacy, where I think ideally all of us have an investment and a commitment to our schools and get involved so that the few people who are most vocal or who have the most sort of skills in negotiating their way through the system don't run the way the system is currently run, or they're currently kind of running the system.
Do you think that her point is interesting about guns and death, et cetera, and sanitizing, probably one of the most gruesome chapters in American history, which was the Civil War. Do you think that that's true in terms of, because when we're talking about privilege sometimes, we're talking about keeping privilege as the result of horribly violent acts of slavery, of lynchings, of all of that. You know, there's a lot of massacres of Native Americans. There's a lot of stuff that's gruesome in history. Have we sanitized all of that to keep people from privilege from having to deal with consequences of actions, or to keep their lives, happier?
I think that sort of sanitizing history does serve to reinforce the current system that we have, where a certain group of people run most of the institutions in our society. So I do think there is a vested interest in keeping our history clean and in keeping the melting pot idea, as opposed to talking about, well, maybe some of these people were the wood who kept the pot, you know, going.
And now that there aren't a lot of other issues, it's just really interesting. It makes me think of, we got to do a talk show on that, Michelle. It would be a really interesting show to figure out all the voices that were heard on that. And thank you so much for your call. Anne is next from Eau Claire. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I'm just wondering what your guest would want to say about, what about when your child has an oppressive teacher?
What do you mean by oppressive, I guess, would be my
first
question. Well,
I'll have to explain a little bit. I'll try to be brief. We live on the south side of Eau Claire. When our son was in sixth grade, they had the team concept.
Mm-hmm.
In our son's team, the team was made of English, math, and social studies. Our children got 3 to 3.5 hours of homework per night. That was not including practicing for musical instruments. I advocated for our son. I spoke with the team teachers, I spoke with the principal, and nothing would be changed, nothing. And he had to endure this for an entire year. And everyone hated it, all the parents hated it. But the teacher refused to change, giving them this much homework, the teachers of the group, the team, and the principal refused to do anything about it either, even though he told me that he was going to talk with them. Nothing ever changed the entire year. It was his worst academic year. He's a sophomore in college now.
Well, I mean, I guess I think there are avenues to try to have better communication between home and school, and I think this is a tricky issue because I do think oftentimes, you know, teachers do view themselves as professionals, rightly so, and have their idea about the philosophy of teaching, and that I wish there were more engagement and dialogue with parents and teachers, with the recognition that the parents are their own teachers of their children. And again, I think right now there's so many divisions that get in the way of having more productive conversations between the communities and the schools. And I think that that's something that we really need to address sort of system-wide about what role parents have within the schools, and ideally have that be a larger community conversation. And I guess I sound a little bit like a broken record, but I think this comes back to what are our notions of democracy, mm-hmm. and, you know, who has a right to advocate on behalf of whom. And I think we need to be having those, ideally, those conversations in school communities that involve parents and that involve community members who maybe are, they don't have children for whatever reason, maybe their children are grown, or I wish that there was, again, more of a sort of community investment and engagement around schooling so that we could have more open conversations about what it is we actually want mm-hmm. for our children.
Yeah, I've always thought it would be a good idea to just involve more of the community, too. There are so many young people who need a little extra help when it comes to reading, or maybe they could mentor if you can't hire music teachers, which you ought to be able to do anyhow, but to have music in people who are musicians come into schools. I would like to see them be much more open places, which might take care of part of that problem, right, to make them more democratic, but also use all the gifts that old people have and everybody has. You know, we all have our gifts. Bring them into the schools.
Right, and I think there are, again, some schools who have done a very good job of kind of having a democratically run school throughout, not only in the classrooms, but across classrooms and with the community. And unfortunately, I do think that this push for accountability and testing just does more to limit that sort of possibility, because sure. I think it is so meaningful when parents come into the classroom and present on their own work, and students get to see their community members and their family within schools. I think that's very powerful for them.
Yeah, I agree. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we'll take more phone calls in just a moment. Connie North is our guest, and we're talking about her book, Teaching for Social Justice, Voices from the Front Lines. We also have an email address, which I guess you could use if you'd like to, and that's talk@wpr.org. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction at the University of Maryland. College Park specializes in teacher and anti-oppressive education, and she is a former Peace Corps volunteer. Two more calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Connie. Ann from La Crosse is our next caller. Hi, Ann. Not there, so let's go to John from Minocqua. Hi, John.
Hi, Kathleen. Good morning, Professor North.
Good morning.
I've got a few connections to make. I'm a retired social studies teacher, and I kind of taught in both communities, at least racially, a community that was predominantly African-American and a community that was predominantly white. And I taught for social justice, or did the best I could. So I think one way to get a handle on this is that first, as you acknowledged, teachers are often kind of intimidated by the status quo as it's presented in textbooks and in standard curriculum designs. So one way I approached that was to think about all history as being local history. You've given some reference to this already. And I believe that in every local history, including our own families, we have cultural liabilities and cultural assets. So what I would try to get kids to do is examine not only their own past, but the community. And in that community, in both cases where I taught, there were always wonderful stories of local individuals and groups and how they engaged issues of justice. Unfortunately, that's left out of textbooks. So in some respects, we've got to rewrite the curriculum and make it more local. Let me give a couple examples. We had a minister in a community, a more affluent white community, that worked with Dr. King, and most people did not know about him. The students certainly didn't. So I had my students contact him and do an oral history with him, and it was one of those great examples of cognitive dissonance that students encountered something that was the furthest from their mind, that somebody actually was engaged and active on behalf of social justice. Just one other example. we were studying American Indians, and I found a woman in our community who was a leader in the Crow community. So students brought her in, and to their surprise, she told a story that was completely counter to what they were studying about American Indians.
Oh, interesting.
So I'll just give you that observation. Oh, and one other connection about the professionalization of teachers. Interestingly, one of the standards in the National Board Certification Movement, which has strengths and liabilities, is teachers need to demonstrate how they work with community and parent groups in active, collaborative ways. So we're recognizing the importance of that. We just need to spread that concept around of how to make schools more democratic in terms of participation and involvement of community and parents.
I'm glad you called, John. Great points.
I'm very glad you brought up National Board Certification, too, because I think the spirit behind bringing together a pool of talented teachers, that, again, the teachers set the standards, much like other professions. My hope is that National Board Certification can get together a cadre of very talented teachers who can go then and influence the educational policymaking world. Unfortunately, I think it's in some communities and settings become a way, because of the financial perks that come with National Board Certification, teachers often get an increase in salary, that it can be going for the National Board Certification because of the money, as opposed to a larger community of like-minded professionals. But I do have hope for the National Board Certification movement. I think it's a good one.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Ann from La Crosse. Hi, Ann.
Good morning.
Hi.
This is just such a valuable topic, and it's been one of my greatest pet peeves of all time, in that why does the educational system not bring forth some of the top people in history who were black? For instance, King David, who married Bathsheba, who begot King Solomon, the wisest of all kings. Why don't they bring forth that information, which had at one time been available, that Bathsheba was a black woman, that King Solomon was indeed a brown king, that Moses married Zipporah, who was also a black woman, a black Ethiopian woman, and the offspring there were brown, of the Levite tribe. It's questionable, and I had heard and said that Hannibal, who brought the elephants and conquered some of Asia with the elephants, was indeed a brown person. Why are these informations, and many more brown people throughout history, why is that not brought forth more readily, so that when, say, for instance, the KKK comes out with information such as where in the history do you see blacks with whites, or the importance of brown people? For that reason, I bring this this point forward.
Thanks, Ann. Connie.
I think you raise a very good point about whose history gets told, and how are we telling this history. And I often refer actually back to the Peace Corps, where I was in a small village and learned about the Columbine shooting in my village. And The people in this very small rural community in West Africa knew so much more about the U.S., than we know about the rest of the world. And I think that it's tied in, and that I think, again, the history that we get told is often limited to a narrow perspective that unfortunately reinforces the power of some, and it's a few people. Mm-hmm. There's so many histories that are not being told in our sort of more standard curriculum.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Here's a email, Connie. Zan from Appleton. I'm a teacher educator who promotes a democratic approach, but when my students get out into the classroom, they encounter resistance from practicing teachers who think their ideas are too idealistic or unworkable. How can new teachers change the system when the resistance is from colleagues?
I guess I was blessed when I was at Madison to work in a PDS, a professional development school partnership, that really tried to help the dialogue, again, the more sort of democratic relationships be cultivated between universities and schools, and to have much more, again, of an engaged dialogue, and then ideally also have more community-based organizations joining into that conversation. I think the university oftentimes reinforces some of these divisions and does not help to value teachers who are really having their work is very intensified, as Kathleen mentioned earlier, and it's really hard right now to be a teacher, I think, out there. So I think there's a way to have these conversations that sometimes our institutions provide more barriers than pathways or bridges to having those conversations. I don't know if that necessarily answers your question, but I think that there are tensions between what's often taught by teacher educators, including myself, and what the students are facing in the schools. And so how to help them through that cognitive dissonance, as the last caller, John, talked about, to keep that cognitive dissonance alive so that we continue to try to question the way things are and recognize they don't have to be this way, mm-hmm. is kind of the goal.
Thanks, Anne, for your call. We go to Viola from Shawano. Hi, Viola.
Hello. How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
Hey, I just have a comment about this lady that called in about the reenactment of the Civil War. I think it was in an Oshkosh school.
Mm-hmm.
And she blamed the liberals for that, that they were against it. And, hey, I am very liberal, and I was for it. I was just amazed that they did not allow that. It's a fact, and history should be taught on facts. And, you know, when I went to school, I graduated in 48. We respected and looked up to teachers, and teachers now are not valued. Everybody thinks they make too much money. But think about all the education they have to go through, and they keep up with their education. They have to, or they get left behind. So that's my say-so, and I'll just hang up and take your comment off.
They don't make nearly enough money. We'll get to the bottom of that Civil War. We'll do a show on that, because we don't know all the details of it. We just heard a story about it, but it raises so many interesting questions that we'll definitely do that. I wanted to ask you about the teachers you brought together and what they learned from each other in term, and how they may have changed their literacy style or added something to their classroom as a result of being with all these other really interesting, good teachers.
I mean, I wish they were here to speak on their own behalf. But I think the powerful part about having a conversation with someone who doesn't teach in your same building is that you have to take a step back and recognize that your kind of the water you are swimming in each day is not the same for other people. And I think it caused a lot of critical reflection on their own settings by virtue of coming up against a setting very different from their own in these conversations. I know that I just was communicating with Margaret via email a few days ago, and she just said it's just on her mind a lot when she's teaching about these various issues and dilemmas, and that I think it helps all of us to become a little bit more intentional about our teaching. I know that for me as a teacher educator, I think constantly about what I saw in these classrooms and our conversations, and try to think about the kind of implications of what I'm doing in my classroom in light of all of these different organizational settings for education out there, and just recognizing that there are a lot of dilemmas and tensions that are not easily resolved, and trying to really be thoughtful about what we're doing.
Right. All right, thanks for your call. And our next caller is, where are you from?
Are you talking to me?
I'm talking to you.
Sheboygan.
Sheboygan, hi.
Hi. I don't you think it's interesting, Kathleen, that on some shows you do, and this is a wonderful show, the callers are men.
Yes.
They own the subject.
Yes.
If John hadn't called today, it would have been an all-female cast.
I know.
And that says something very significant about teaching in the profession. I am a retired teacher. I taught in the South Bronx and in Houston. And I would like to know I have macular degeneration now, and so I can't tutor reading anymore. I would like to do exactly what your guest says, which is in you, which change it from the top down. How do we who care get together to make a community difference with parents and with the community through the schools?
All right, Helen. I love your question.
Real specific. Like, mm-hmm. I've been a community organizer at times. I'd like to know, you know, how does one go about this? That's the best thing we could all do, is change this perspective from greed to need into some kind of social justice.
All right, do that in a minute, can you, Connie? And then we're out of time. Thanks, Helen.
I think there are some very wonderful models out there of parent-led organization or community-based organizations that, you know, I was just down in El Paso on an alternative spring break, and there was a program, Avance, that was helping largely undocumented parents become involved in their students' education and themselves learn English and get their GEDs. And it was a kind of empowerment for all sort of a program where everyone was benefiting in some ways. And I guess the simplest thing, though, I think, is that we have to start by wanting to actually listen and hear other people's perspectives that aren't our own. And that includes not just in terms of ethnic, racial, sexual differences, but in terms of people in different institutional roles. So again, you know, teachers really valuing what parents have to say about their children and parents valuing what teachers have to say. And I just think we don't emphasize active listening in our society enough.
Yeah. Connie, thanks so much. What a great book and a great conversation.
Thank you so much, and thank you to the callers.
Connie North, and Connie's book is Teaching for Social Justice, Voices from the Front Lines. It is published by Paradigm Press and available in paperback. She is a professor in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction at the University of Maryland, College Park, and specializes in teacher and anti-oppressive education. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. I'll be with you again on Monday at 9. We'll be doing all things political, as we always do Monday at 9, and have another full week of great shows. So thanks. Until then, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.